funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Andrew Solomon has a hypothesis. If all young adults were required to spend 2 weeks in a foreign country, two-thirds of the world's diplomatic problems could be solved. It isn't really something you can prove in a laboratory, but it's a deeply compelling idea. If we all made an effort to understand people, places, and cultures that look foreign from a distance, we would develop greater tolerance for differences and gain a sense of how strange our own assumptions must seem to people abroad. Solomon himself has been kidnapped, socked in the jaw, doused with ram's blood, and taken for a white supremacist on his travels through the world. He has often been uncomfortable, physically, socially, and emotionally. But while he hasn't enjoyed all his excursions in the moment, he has come to value every experience. Andrew Solomon is professor of clinical psychology at Columbia University, president of Penn American Center, and a regular contributor to NPR, The New York Times Magazine, and The New Yorker. His new book is called Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, Seven Continents, 25 Years. Andrew, welcome back to Think.
What a thrill to be here again.
You were born into a family deeply traumatized by the Holocaust. So as a little kid, you got it in your head that you always needed somewhere else to go if things got bad.
Yes, nobody in my family had been subject to the Holocaust. They were all here in the United States. But I remember as a small child, my father telling me about the Holocaust. And he thought I already knew about it. He mentioned it in passing. And I said, "What are you talking about?" And when he explained it, I remember being so shaken by the idea of that horror, as I think anyone would be. And then I said to him, "But why didn't those people just leave when things got so bad?" And he said, "They had no place to go." And I remember thinking then, I was 6 or 7 years old, I thought, I will always have some place to go. I am not going to get into that situation. I had the sense that it was important, that it was helpful. To always have friends in other places and other places ready to welcome you.
So you worked very hard to get UK citizenship, and this might seem like starter travel to some people, but it's a really foreign culture despite what we have in common with language.
I went to graduate school in England when I finished my undergraduate degree here, and I had been kind of an Anglophile for a long time without really understanding England very well. And I ended up loving England, but for slightly different reasons than the ones I thought I would before I went. And I stayed on and I worked there for a few years. If you ask me about my 500 closest friends, insofar as there is any such thing, most of them are in the U.S. But if you ask me about my 10 closest friends, half of them are in the U.K. It was a very formative set of experiences. And I think that living there really gave me a sense in a lot of ways of what was American in me and what was universal and what was specific to the language we more or less share. And I made very deep and lasting attachments there. And then after I'd had a visa for a certain number of years, my solicitor said to me, "You know, you've had an artist visa for some time. You could actually qualify to be naturalized as a citizen." And I said, "Could I?" And he said, "Yes." He said, "You only have to meet these 7 criteria." And 6 of the criteria were fine. I'd always paid my taxes. I'd never been arrested for a felony and so on and so forth. The 7th one was that I not have spent more than 2 weeks outside of England in any of the preceding 7 years. And by that time, I was more or less living in New York. So I said, "Well, I don't meet this one." And he said, "You're probably out of luck then." And I said, "Could I write a letter or something?" And he said, "You can try." So I wrote a letter more or less in jest and said that while I was living mostly in New York and was doing a lot of reporting from Russia, that in my heart I was loyal to the Queen. And there must have been a very bored clerk on duty that day because I got citizenship papers by return post.
Do you have an English identity?
I have an identity in England. I find now that many of my closest friends are Americans who live there or English people who live here. I go back and forth, and I think that sense of displacement, that permanent sense of not being entirely of one place, is what I've taken away from it.
You've done so much traveling in China. Over the years, surely some things that were entirely foreign to you have come to feel somewhat familiar. How did your relationship to the place change as you started to realize things that once took you by surprise you could expect?
Well, in part, my changing relationship with China has also had to do with the changing nature of China. I went there the first time in 1982. Everyone was wearing Mao suits. They were riding bicycles along dusty lanes. Now, of course, you go and it feels like the future. It feels like it's a million years ahead of any place else in the world. I got used to the language and the food and those obvious things. But I think I also got used to the complexity of thought and the indirection that seemed to me to be characteristic of a lot of the art I was looking at when I was there. I was very much struck by conversations I had with people in China, including someone who had been an activist during the Tiananmen Square period, and who said to me that he was glad that Tiananmen Square had ended the way it did. And I looked at him utterly bewildered, and I said, "What on earth do you mean you were glad that it ended the way it did?" And he said, "If the protesters had succeeded, there would have been chaos in China. You can't govern a country this size in a pure democracy." He said, "More people, far more people would have been killed than got killed the way things were." And I said, "But what about your ideals?" And he said, "I'm an artist, and it's a good thing for artists to work to ideals. And those are my ideals." He said, "But it would be a terrible thing for government to be working to ideals. A government has to function."
That's so very different from the way we like to think of ourselves here. We have so much pride in Western-style democracy, and many Americans genuinely believe that if we could export this to the rest of the world, the rest of the world would be better off. Do you believe that?
Well, there are two pieces to that. The first is the idea that we can export it to the rest of the world. And I think often a false assumption is made that democracy is the default state of human beings and that if you remove the impediments, it's what will rise to the surface. My experience is that democracy has to be very elaborately and carefully constructed and that what happens when you remove everything else is complete and total chaos. I feel like that assumption that we would all become the same was part of what drove the war in Iraq and became so disastrous, or the fighting in Libya. Beyond that, I think that the notion of people wanting democracy, people want some degree of self-determination. They want to have that. They want more than that, mostly, I think, to feel safe and secure. They want to be able to make their own decisions and define who they are. There are many versions of democracy. I mean, the shattering thing is to realize that people aren't waiting to turn into the United States or Western Europe. The Chinese people actually like China. They might like to change some things about the way it's governed, but they kind of like China, and they want to do things in a Chinese way. And I think they're very resistant to the idea that they only need to be educated better, and then they'd want to be just like us.
You got tangled up in this very strange situation with artists in Taiwan and this exhibition that was supposed to take place at the Met. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
The Met Museum was doing a loan exhibition of work from the National Palace Museum in Taiwan. The Imperial Collection was one of the last things that Chiang Kai-shek took with him when he fled to Taiwan. He brought it all in many boxes. It had been the property of emperors over thousands of years. It was the great collection of Chinese art in a way that most cultures, the art has been diffused and it's gone to various places. It was all there. It had never really traveled in very much quantity. And then the Met Museum decided on this loan exhibition. And I was invited to come to Taiwan to write a piece about this lovely cooperation between the Met Museum and the Taiwanese government and how wonderful it was that these great pictures were coming. And I went to Taiwan and I reported that story and started writing it. And then I got a call from a friend in Taipei who said, "Are you aware that there's a protest movement here about the exhibition?" So I got on the next plane and I went back to Taipei. And there were many people who felt that it was terrible for these things to travel. Terrible because the plane could go down. Terrible because there were many of them that seemed to represent symbolically the power of the government. And terrible because there were fears that Beijing would try to take them back. And how did they know that the United States wouldn't return them? And it got very heated. I mean, thousands of people marching, fights going on in the parliament. And one night I was out having drinks with a friend in Taipei. We were having beer with salted prunes, which is what you drink in Taipei. And I was talking about the whole question. I said, "You know, I really don't think people understand. I think the Met Museum is really..." And I was starting to explain things. And there was someone who was apparently on with the protest movement who thought I worked for the museum, who came and socked me in the jaw. And the friend I was having drinks with said, "We've got to get out of here. This could turn really nasty." And I thought, wow, I got through Afghanistan without being physically attacked. I got through Libya. I thought, Taipei, that's where I suddenly got socked in the jaw. But it was also moving to realize how deeply people identified with that art and how much significance it had to them, and how passionately they felt about it. I thought, you know, there are things loaned out of the Met Museum, out of the National Gallery. I've never seen a lot of protesters marching up and down.
What kinds of changes have you seen in China with regard to the way that artists are trained? There's this long tradition of everyone learning to do things exactly the same way, which is not how we conceive of art in the West, certainly in contemporary time.
There's always been a lot of focus in China on copying from your predecessors, and adding something or changing something or working in a different way is a right that you earn after many, many years of apprenticeship. For a long time, one of the defining characteristics, not only of Chinese art, but of the whole nation, was its connection to tradition, its unbroken history. You know, they talk a lot about a 5,000-year unbroken history. Now, with the incursion of Western values, there's a lot more focus on radicalism and on doing things that are politicized and on making big and significant changes in the way that you present things. So there's an avant-garde in China. And there's also a sense that the art, which was always subtly, I mean, classical Chinese painting is actually quite subtly political and often alluded to things that were meaningful in the context of the imperial government. And there were many painters who were sent into exile or even executed for what they had painted, even though to us they look like sort of pretty landscapes a lot of the time. But the politics has grown more intense and more forward and more profound. I was very moved by an installation that was done by an artist called Zhang Peili that I saw in the early 1990s. There was a woman newscaster on the news in China who had been the one who reported everything that happened in Tiananmen, or didn't report some of it. And he felt that whoever controlled what she said controlled the fate of China, because there were so many people who tuned in every day. And after doing a lot of research, he found out that she loved flowers. And so he wrote to her via various intermediaries and said that he was doing an exhibition of flowers and he would like her to just read a text from a classical encyclopedia about water. And she agreed to do it for a fee, and he videotaped her doing it. And if you went to the exhibition, it was an exhibition of flowers with this videotape playing in the corner. And you thought, oh, it's someone who likes flowers. But if you thought about it and understood it, you realized this disenfranchised marginal artist had determined what the newscaster who spoke to all of China was going to read aloud, and that it was a way of revealing how you could, in fact, gain power over what seemed an impenetrable bureaucracy.
And that is context you simply couldn't have unless you had a really deep familiarity with this other culture.
Yes. And a lot of what I found as I went and looked at art from other places, there had been an argument for a long time that whatever looked like what was happening here was derivative, and whatever looked different was provincial, and the general assumption that there couldn't be any interesting art from outside a Western context. I was in Moscow in the late 1980s, and I saw all this art that I thought wasn't really very interesting. I went there to write a kind of comic social piece about Sotheby's having a sale of art and getting all kinds of fancy people to go out there. And then I met the artists and discovered that the work was full of these hidden meanings, and that the key to understanding those meanings was knowing the other artists, and that they had all intended only to show to one another because they had no opportunity to go broader and more commercial. And it soon became clear that it was intimacy with them that gave you the clues to what it all really meant.
We're speaking this hour with Andrew Solomon. He's professor of clinical psychology at Columbia and a regular contributor to NPR, The New York Times Magazine, and The New Yorker. His new book is called Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, Seven Continents, 25 Years. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can follow along on social media at the hashtag ThinkInDC.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Andrew Solomon about his new book, Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, Seven Continents, 25 Years. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can follow along on social media using the hashtag ThinkInDC. Andrew, do you think Americans are more xenophobic than people from other cultures, or is American hegemony just responsible for making that xenophobia more apparent?
Well, some of each. I mean, we're partly more xenophobic because we're such a big country, and it's possible to travel around within the United States and not really encounter a lot of otherness. If you're living in Belgium, you know, you go 50 miles and you're in another country, so that forces you into a different way of thinking. I feel like American xenophobia has been stoked a lot, especially during this electoral season. And I think that the fear of people who are different and other is very poisonous. It's poisonous for the people you're afraid of, but it's also poisonous for the people who are afraid. There are people out there who wish us ill and would like to be destructive to all of our interests, and we have to identify who they are. We have existing enemies. But I think in the expressions of xenophobia, we make a lot of new enemies whom we don't need, in fact, to have. I was very struck when I was in Libya in the late Gaddafi period by the fact that all of the people in government who I met who wanted rapprochement with the West were people who had studied at some point in the US or the UK. And all of the people I met who were opposed to engaging with the West had never studied in a Western context. And I just thought, on the one hand, the 9/11 hijackers were given visas and they came here, and perhaps if they hadn't been, it wouldn't have happened, or it wouldn't have happened in the way that it did. But the idea that you can build walls, that you can exclude everyone, that you can close down immigration, and that you can stay in the safe fortress of home and thereby make yourself safer, I think is not only not a very pleasant way to live in the world, but I also think it makes things more dangerous. It's very hard for people to love a place they've never seen. And if we don't let people in, and if we don't ourselves go out, there's no real communication. And I think travel is a means of communication, a very, very precious one.
It's not impossible to travel to many parts of the world and not really have a very different experience. Our producer, Jeff Whittington, is recently back from Cuba and has been telling this story about I guess in the lobby of their hotel, shouting at the desk clerk, seeing this woman shouting, "We want a place that serves French fries." You know, and you know, I wonder. I think sometimes people travel, but they don't necessarily experience everything that a new place has to offer.
Well, I've tried to draw a distinction between tourism and travel, which is a little bit artificial. But tourism is mostly about going to someplace else and looking out at it, and frequently contrasting it negatively with the place that you come from. And travel is about going and engaging with a place and understanding how people think and live there and recognizing what the strengths and triumphs of it are. Now, everyone does both. Even the woman who was yelling about French fries had probably been someplace in Cuba and been amazed by something that she saw or amazed by something she heard or interacted with somebody local. And even the most inveterate traveler sometimes has moments of thinking, what am I doing in this weird place? So there's always some of each. But I think there's a need to some degree for people who are going touristically to at least be aware that there is such a thing as travel and to try not simply to witness, but actually to be involved in the place where they've gone.
So ambitious travel is not necessarily all uncomfortable or unpleasant, but it can be, and it is at certain points. Why is it so important that we go?
My point of view is that I don't want to go very uncomfortably to any place where I could equally well go very comfortably, but I also don't ever want to miss seeing anything because I can't be comfortable there. So I'm willing to be uncomfortable when the discomfort actually accomplishes something. I think people are sometimes uncomfortable because they're in places where, I don't know, the plumbing isn't up to standards or where there aren't such luxury beds. But I think a lot of the discomfort comes from going to places where people are not necessarily inclined to like you. They're not inclined to like you because you're American or because you're white or because you're middle-aged or because you're whatever else it is that you may be. And it's important to go sometimes to places like that to try to understand, what is it about the place I come from or who I am that might be off-putting to people, And how hard is it really to get them to shift their point of view, at least in relation to me? I think travel has to also be reciprocal. If you go someplace and you're only looking at it and you're not telling people anything, it doesn't work. You have to be ready to answer their questions as much as you want them to answer yours.
You went to South Africa, and it was assumed by a lot of people that you belonged with the white apartheid separatists.
Wasn't exactly the separatists, but I got there and I was white. I'd been working before that mostly in Russia and China. And, you know, in Russia and in China, there was no confusion between me and the ruling overclass. I was not a member of the Politburo. I was clearly not part of the Chinese government. When I got to South Africa, though, I went to meet all these artists and thought, you know, I'm going to do the same old thing. And the black artist spoke to me as a white person, and that meant sometimes with anger and sometimes with uncomfortable deference and in a variety of other ways that were very disorienting. And it was very difficult for me to sort out what it meant to be there. I mean, I am white. I'm not South African. I had protested apartheid. I certainly wasn't part of the system that was in place there. What I was struck by as I talked to black and white artists there was that they were trying very hard to arrive at a society in which the art would just be considered as art and their ethnicity would be irrelevant. And I remember in one day when I happened to be talking to a black artist and said to him, "How did you decide to become an artist?" And he said, "Well, I always liked to draw, but I had no idea you could do this as a career." And then one day a friend of mine said there were these people called artists and they just did nothing but paint all day. And I thought, oh, that's what I want to do and that's what I want to be. He said, I was 15 years old. And then I spoke to the white artist and he said, when I was 15 years old, I was seated at a lunch in London next to Andy Warhol. And he said, you should really think about being an artist. And I thought, I'm going to go for it and try it. And I thought, okay. You're talking about someone who had never heard of artists until he was 15 and someone else who had access to Andy Warhol. They both were doing really good and interesting work, but you couldn't judge it all the same way. And I had to recognize that I had more in common with the international one than with the one who had been repressed and held locally. And I had to try to broaden my horizons enough to see both kinds of work clearly.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now, and we'll speak to Augustine in Fort Worth. Hi, Augustine.
Hi. I just wanted to say that it's very important that elected officials, especially those at the federal level, have had some foreign experience, so in case they have to pass laws or some kind of legislation that would have any international impact, the experience will come in handy, you know. Because a lot of laws that are passed in the U.S. would have a long-term, implication overseas.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think it's shocking when people are running for high public office who have had the opportunity to travel and haven't done so. I've said that I think that travel is really a moral act and that for those who have the means to do so, which is obviously not the whole population, it's really important to open yourself up to the rest of the world. And if you're making decisions about some place, try to figure out how people work there. You know, I got to be friendly with Robert McNamara near the end of his life. And he had, of course, been the architect of the Vietnam War. And he was describing to me going to Vietnam. And he said when he went back there after many years and met with some of his counterparts, their whole conversation consisted of him saying, "Well, why did you do so-and-so?" And they're saying, "Well, because you were escalating by doing such-and-such." And he said, "We weren't escalating. We were de-escalating by doing that because we thought so-and-so." And then he would say, "But then you did such-and-such." And they just had misunderstood everything. And he said, "We spoke in the language of war, which I thought was a universal language, but it turned out that it was not." Elected officials need to be able to speak in the sort of intellectual or psychological or emotional or patriotic language of other countries. They don't agree with what's being done or said there necessarily, but they need at least to understand it before they make policy decisions.
You've been to a lot of places where I have to assume people don't realize that you are quite well known in this country. But I'm wondering if you still feel a sense that you are a kind of de facto ambassador for Americans and American culture when you travel.
I think everyone who travels is an ambassador for his country. It doesn't matter whether you're prominent or not prominent or whether you're there for 2 days or there for 2 months. People see you and they make a decision. What are Americans like, in part on the basis of their interaction with you? And there's a responsibility attached to that. It's important to know that and to try to live up to that responsibility. That doesn't mean you can't have a nice vacation and enjoy a Caribbean island without feeling like you're giving speeches the whole time. Just remember, though, that people come away with an impression and you're part of what makes that impression, and that in your tiny way, you then ultimately contribute to the way nations see one another and to peace and justice or the absence of same in the world.
At a time when your writing was really focused on depression and mental illness, you got curious about how people countenance depression in other places. And someone said, go to Senegal, where depression is not unknown to people who only, you know, have access to tribal medicine. They know exactly what it is, but they deal with it in a really different way.
I was very much interested in these tribal rituals, a form of exorcism for depression. And in Senegal, I had gone with a friend of a cousin of someone who knew the girlfriend of a friend of mine to see a woman who performed the ritual of the Undup, which was a sort of exorcism. And I interviewed her about it, and it was very interesting. At the end of the interview, I said, well, thank you so much. I said, it's been absolutely fascinating hearing all of this. Could I be here the next time you do an Undup? And she said, well, I've never had a foreigner do that, but I guess you could. Yes, you came through friends. And I said, when will you next be doing one? And she said, oh, sometime in the next 6 months. And I said, that's kind of a long time for me to be here in this small village waiting. Is there any way we could get one on the books a little faster? And she said, no, not really. And just as I was leaving, she said, excuse me. She said, I hope you don't mind my saying this, but you don't look so great yourself. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, well. And she said, I could do an end-up for you. Never done one for a foreigner, certainly, but I could. So I said, okay, and we left, and my translator said to me, you are completely crazy. How can you possibly be even considering this? And I won't take you through the whole drama of the ritual, but I will say the high point came when I was in a makeshift wedding bed with a ram in the central square of the village. The entire population was dancing around us in circles. Pieces of cloth were being thrown over us. Drummers were drumming. And at a certain key moment, the cloth was yanked back. I was pulled to my feet. The loincloth that was all I was wearing was pulled off. The ram's throat was slit, and I was covered in the blood of the freshly slaughtered ram. And I thought, this is a far cry from psychiatry as practiced in my corner of the world. But there was a lot about it that was very powerful. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, okay, they've identified the depression as something which is intrusive and which has come from outside and which can be cast away. They've taken people and put them in bright sunlight with drumming going on and all of those things that are very energizing. But most of all, the entire village had taken a day off from their work in the fields to come together and acknowledge this problem and try to help with it. And I thought, here we so often go around with the shame and stigma and secrecy and not wanting people in our community to know. So it's not that I think we should all give up psychoanalysis and start doing undups all over town, only that I think often when you engage with a situation which feels so profoundly and totally alien, you discover that there are bits of wisdom hidden in it that you can take home with you.
Did it take you by surprise? I mean, did you expect to go through this and think, well, that's fine for the Senegalese, but it's going to do nothing for me?
Yes, because I thought the reason that it worked was mostly that people believed in the animist principles behind it. And I didn't believe, as they had told me, that my body was covered in spirits who were jealous of my sexual relationships on Earth. And so I didn't think I believed in the concept. And it wasn't until after it had taken place that I thought, okay, well, that language of these spirits and their jealousies and so on is a kind of framing device for some very real and practical things. In Senegal, you're thought to have spirits all over you, sort of the way we have microbes all over us. And it's thought that you can do all of these things to pacify and mollify them. I don't think that I had spirits that were mollified. I think it was an incredibly moving and exhilarating experience nonetheless.
Will you eat anything served to you when you're abroad?
No, I won't. And when I'm in places where I really can't stand the food, I tend to lose weight, which is always good. You know, try the Kazakhstan diet if you want to. But I have had to eat a lot of very, very peculiar things in various places where I am, some of which have turned out to be better than one would have thought. I remember when I was in Greenland and I was in an Inuit encampment and I had developed a cold, and somebody said to me, oh, all you need is a few good bowls of whale soup. And I came over and indeed we had whale soup and it was delicious. But I remember being at a banquet in Taiwan at which I was seated next to the prime minister, and they brought out a gigantic bowl of sea slugs. And I thought, I'm next to the prime minister and this is what he's serving. I just have to do this. I've endured a certain amount of stuff I wouldn't want. Not that the aficionados don't love sea slugs. I happen not to.
Inevitably, if you are headed even to Europe, someone on the plane has a baby and someone else will say, I would never think of disrupting my child's life this way by taking this trip now. Why not wait until later?
I have taken my children on travels from the very beginning. Now, people said, your child will never remember these travels. He's 2 years old or she's 3 years old. And part of what I've said in response to that is that we don't live our current life only to manufacture future memories. But I've also said, even if my children don't remember the specifics of the places where we went, they will grow up with the sense that the world is a big and rich and varied place and that there are a lot of different experiences to be had in it. And I think that's a wonderful way to grow up and gives them a really broad perspective. We said to my son recently, who has just turned 7, he was still 6 when we had this conversation. He said, George, if you could go anywhere in the world, where would you most like to go? And he said, Syria. And my husband and I looked at him and said, Syria? George, what are you talking about? Why would you want to go to Syria? And he said, using a phrase that actually occurs frequently in our household, he said, someone has to talk to those people about unacceptable behavior.
You're raising a diplomat as we speak.
I'm trying.
Andrew Solomon is with us. He's professor of clinical psychology at Columbia, a contributor to NPR and the New York Times Magazine and The New Yorker. He has a new book out called Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, 7 Continents, 25 Years. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter and follow along with the hashtag ThinkInDC.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Andrew Solomon, president of Penn American Center and professor of clinical psychology at Columbia University. His new book is called Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, 7 Continents, 25 Years. You can join us at think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think with the hashtag ThinkInDC. Andrew, does traveling with your children give you permission to go to places that are for tourists?
It does. And it's actually lovely to get that permission to go to those places again. I went with my children to Venice, and my son was sort of mostly interested in the motorboats, but my daughter, I could see her waking up to how unbelievably beautiful everything was. And the smile on her face, now memorialized on photos on my phone, was unbelievably gratifying. It was just lovely to sort of go and get ice cream and go for a ride in a gondola and walk through streets that I might not otherwise ever have had occasion to go to. I feel very lucky that my mother, who loved travel, gave me the world. And I feel very lucky insofar as I'm able to give the world to my children.
How do you feel about the day each trip ends when you're on your way home?
You know, I find it difficult going away, and I find it difficult going home. I know there are many people who feel just the opposite. They're excited at the beginning of the vacation and ready to return by the end of it. And of course, at some level, that's true. But I always feel like I'm being ripped apart from everything that's familiar, And then just when I've got used to someplace else, I find myself being pulled apart again. And I used to think, oh, I get a little depressed in airplanes during takeoff, and it must have to do with the cabin pressure, or it must have to do with the sound of the engines, and if I only got headphones or slept more. And then I finally realized it's not a physiological problem. It's a psychological problem. It's the sense of, but I'm leaving everything behind there, whatever the everything is of the moment. Usually, however, by the time I land, I'm pretty glad to be wherever it is I'm going, whether it's home or abroad.
It's sort of a trite thing to say, but a lot of people talk about, you know, if you travel enough, you realize that people are very similar the world over. I'm curious, though, about what you've learned about connecting with people who really do think in very different ways from you.
I think that a lot of the secret of engaging with people is reciprocity. It's the idea that you are not only hearing about how they think, but also telling them a little bit about how you think. You know, journalists have this ideal of neutrality, and I don't actually believe in neutrality. In the first place, I don't think it's possible. And in the second place, I don't think it's very generous. I think the generous thing is to be engaged. Now, I've met people abroad whose lives are incredibly different, and I felt that that difference was very moving. I have met also people who were involved in activity that was damaging to women or to gay people or to racial minorities and felt like what I was encountering was wrong and morally troubling. So I don't think you can just say, well, you know, you go every place and you see what everyone does and you just respect all of what they do. There are cultures into which very dangerous attitudes have been incorporated. But try, if you want to look at those, to understand them from the perspective of the people in that culture first, and to hold your judgment as long as you can until you finally deliver it. And try to understand where it comes from. I mean, in Afghanistan, I remember interviewing three women who were liberal women who arrived for the interview wearing burqas, took them off when they came inside. I said, why are you still wearing those things? And the first one said, you know, I hate this thing. And I always thought that if the Taliban fell, I would stop wearing it. But if I do and I get raped, people will say that it's my own fault. And the second one said, I never wanted to wear this anymore, but if the Taliban comes back to power, people who didn't wear it will be in trouble. And then the third one said to me, I thought I would burn this the day the Taliban fell. She said, but for 5 years, I got used to being invisible. And if you are used to being invisible, the process of becoming visible again is very stressful, and I don't know that I'm ready for it. And I thought, oh, don't just think these women are somehow bowing down to authority, but also don't think they're doing this because it's their deep conviction. The psychology behind behavior that looks alien is often very profound, very complicated, sometimes heartbreaking.
How many languages do you speak fluently?
One. Okay. This one. Bad French.
There are people who are very articulate in their native language, who are especially daunted about going somewhere that they can't communicate with words. You have a really interesting story about the time you spent with artists in Russia. There was no translator available for a while. What were you able to learn that you wouldn't have if you had understood every word of their conversations?
It was my third day in Russia. I had gone off to interview these artists. I had been stood up by my translator. They said, in very limited, they said someone would come along who could speak French, which I do, in fact, speak badly. And so I just waited, and I ended up waiting all day. And while I was waiting all day in their studios, I saw them interacting with one another, and they were laughing and laughing. And I understood that work that looked quite uninteresting to me struck them as hilarious, and that work that didn't seem to have much emotional content made people angry or made people weep. And I just saw how they were responding to the work. And I thought, I don't know what it is in that work that's funny or terrifying or anger-invoking or tearful, but there's something there that I can't see. And I think if I'd had a translator, I would have asked them a lot of questions. I would have gotten a lot of sort of formal answers, and that's all I would have known. Being there and watching that way, I suddenly understood there was an intimacy it was going to take me a long time to penetrate.
You had a terrifying experience when you were, I guess, in your early 20s. You just graduated from college, and you and your brother were traveling with your parents.
Yes, we were in Ecuador, and we had gone to see the Galapagos. My parents were coming to the Galapagos, but didn't come on the rest of it. And David and I had gone off to see the ruins at Ingapirca, and we'd been told that there had been some unrest in the area, but we didn't think much of it. And we were on the way back, and suddenly as we were driving along, we came to a road where there was a giant boulder. And we thought, what is the boulder doing in the middle of the road? And people jumped out from behind sort of some shrubs on the side and smashed the windshield and smashed the mirrors and began driving nails into the tires. And we were kind of pulled out of the car, and we were taken and locked in a hut. We tried to figure out what was going on. We had a sort of driver translator with us. He explained that we were there because the local people were in rebellion against the central government because they didn't like paying taxes. And we said that he was welcome to tell them that we weren't so crazy about paying taxes either. We were held for the afternoon, and eventually they let us go, and we then had to walk for many, many miles before we could hitchhike back into the town that we were coming from. What was striking to me in that experience was that it was, on the one hand, unbelievably frightening, and on the other hand, unbelievably fascinating. And I ended up with one of my mottos, which is either you have a good time or you have a good story to tell.
They may not necessarily mutually exclusive, but
indeed,
often are. I'm curious about the way that you make decisions about where you want to go. Are you almost always traveling with some kind of professional objective in mind?
I've come to really like traveling with a professional objective in mind because it lets me get deeper into the places where I've gone. And having done so much of the kind of travel I have, I feel if I've only gone to kind of look around and see some monuments, I mean, it's lovely, of course, to go to, you know, a beautiful city and sit in a cafe or something like that. That kind of travel is delightful. But if I'm going to someplace complicated and difficult, I kind of want to get in it. And it does become, in a way, an addiction. It makes it hard for me just to go, I don't know, I was in Rio de Janeiro, I was doing a travel story, I could have just looked at the nice hotels there. I became very interested in the relationship between the slum dwellers, the people in the favelas, and the people in the more prosperous parts of the city, and ended up doing research about it and wrote an essay that's in the book. It just allowed me to understand that society. It allowed me to be, for a moment, to be part of what I was experiencing rather than just looking at it.
What kind of perspective have you gained on wealth and poverty traveling outside the United States?
Well, what was striking in Rio was that the favelas are dotted throughout the city, sort of like the chocolate chips in a cookie, they relate to the geography of the city, that the people who are living in the non-impoverished areas actually recognize that funk music and a lot of football stars and a lot of top models have come out of the favelas. And they have a sort of admiration for them. What I've learned overall is that societies in which there is less economic injustice are mostly happier societies. They mostly function better. People mostly live in less fear in them. I am struck over and over again by the fact that there is always more of a middle than people realize. So many journalists, when they report from abroad, are either interviewing business leaders and politicians who give rather canned remarks, and then they say, but then, and they come up with the common man, and they have a quotation from the barber or from the taxi driver or from the person who served food in their hotel. And I feel like there's always a vast middle, and the people in that vast middle are often thinking in quite profound ways about the place where they live and the experiences they have. And if you can get at that middle, that broad middle, that's when you'll learn about the place you're looking at.
Are there existential questions you had about the world at the start of your decision as an adult to travel that you've been able to answer after all this time?
I would say there are questions I've been able to answer and also questions that have become more urgent to me. In 1991, I was in Moscow during the coup that turned out to end the Soviet Union. And I was with the artists of Moscow as we all sort of gathered on the barricades and built the barricades to establish the resistance to the coup. And it was very difficult at the time to understand whether what we were doing was accomplishing anything or not. On the third day of the coup, a column of tanks came up to one of the barricades where we were. And the soldier said, if you get out of the way, we have no reason to harm you. But if you don't, we have unconditional orders to destroy this barricade, and we'll have no choice but to run you down. And one of the artists said, give us just a minute. Give us just a minute to tell you why we're here. And launched into a disquisition on freedom and justice and democracy that those of us who live in free, just democracies would be incapable of, and said, you don't remember the days of oppression. Let me tell you what they were like. They were terrible. And he gave the speech, and all of the others joined in, and they all collectively spoke about it. And as they did so, I thought, this language is actually having an effect. And when they finished, the soldier on the front tank said, what you have said is true, and we must bow to the will of the people. If you'll clear us enough space to turn around, we'll go back and leave you, your barricade. And I thought in that moment, if you can only find the words for things, you can actually make much greater changes than you would ever, ever have believed.
You've been so prolific over the years with your writing. I was amused to read that you thought it would be very simple to pull a book like this together because you just take some of your best essays and you republish them and you make some money and you go on a book tour. It was much more complicated than that.
It was much more complicated because I really came to feel as I looked over the material that the whole was greater than the sum of its parts. A lot of the pieces I rewrote or changed because I wanted to get the tone more consistent. I wrote introductions and conclusions to each piece to place them in context. But more than that, I tried to pick out the overarching argument. And the overarching argument really, I think, is that in a globalized world, our attempts to circle the wagons are terribly misguided. And that if you have engaged with a large number of places by going there, or perhaps just by reading my descriptions of going there, it makes you less frightened in the world. I hope this book will make people less afraid. It's meant to be a sort of treatise against fear. And that seems more and more and more urgent as people have had their fear stoked more and more. And once I understood that I had a big purpose, then it couldn't just be scanning in a bunch of stuff I did a long time ago.
It's strange that we are so afraid in a place that is so relatively safe.
And it's strange that people are often most afraid in the safest parts of the place where we live. You know, the rate of fear of terrorism is lower in New York than it is in Coeur d'Alene in Idaho, according to various statistics. I think we all have gotten so much more safe in many ways than we used to be that anything that violates our safety seems frightening. I also think that the unsafety has come to feel very random. You know, these strange shootings that suddenly take place on a military base or in a parking lot or where things get blown up. There isn't a sense that there's any order or predictability to it. And unpredictable stress is far and away the most stressful. But I think it's possible to become less afraid. It's possible to recognize that most of the people who are different don't wish you ill. They wish you love.
Andrew Solomon is professor of clinical psychology at Columbia University and a regular contributor to NPR, The New York Times Magazine, and The New Yorker. His new book is Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, Seven Continents, 25 Years. Andrew, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for making this time for us.
Oh, Chris, thank you so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker, and Jeff Whittington is our executive producer. Our team back in Dallas-Fort Worth today includes Shelley Canavy and Stephanie Kuo. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can follow along all week with the hashtag ThinkInDC. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.